In just a minute, I decided to do a five-part Bible study on five parables because of the theme for Holden this summer, On Earth as in Heaven. I understand parables as stories into which we are invited, and invited to participate not as spectators of a drama that is acted out in front of us, but as participants and actors within the story. And that inside the story of the parable, we experience God's reign not as a future reality, not as something that is going to happen later, but as a present reality, as the inbreaking of God's kingdom, God's realm, God's reign among us here and now. In the past, throughout the church's history, the parables have been read in a variety of ways. Two of the most familiar ways are as allegories and as stories which reveal an ancient or lasting truism. The allegorical reading of parables is preserved for us even in Scripture. The earliest Christian church allegorized the parables. One of the best familiar examples of this is in Matthew 13, the story of the sower and the seeds. Jesus tells the story of a sower who goes out and randomly and extravagantly sows seed on all kind of ground, and much of the seed is eaten, and some of the seed takes shallow root but dies under the scorching sun. Some of the seed doesn't even penetrate the hard soil. But miracle of miracles, a harvest comes in spite of the tremendous odds against the fruitfulness of the seed. And what the early church did, the Matthean church anyway, is allegorize that and begin to say, the seed stands for the Word of God. The weeds stand for worldly cares and anxieties that choke out the Word of God, and so forth. But the writer from whom I take much of my understanding of parables, John Dominic Crossan, says that that was not Jesus's original intent. We always walk delicately on the ground when we start talking about the original and authentic intent of Jesus, but it's an exciting ground to walk on. Crossan says Jesus did not tell the stories in order that they be allegorized, that we find out what does this stand for, what does this really mean, but as stories that we are invited to participate in order to experience a new reality, to experience the reality of God's gracious coming among us. So we are going to try not to allegorize these parables that we study. The temptation to do so will be great, because we've read parables this way so long, and I may even lapse into it, and then you are invited to call me on it. The other way that parables are often read as stories, almost like fables or stories that reveal a truism, such as the last will be first and the first will be last, which Crossan also says is an addition to the parable, not part of the original parable that Jesus spoke. The early church's way of saying, if you boil this story down to its one little nugget, to its mysterious little meaning, it is that the first will be last and the last will be first. The question isn't, is that true or not, that the first will be last and the last will be first? The question is that what Jesus intends us to do with the parables, to boil them down till we get a concentrated truth out of them? And again, we're going to try to resist doing that with the parables that we look at in this session. We're going to try instead to imagine ourselves inside the world of the parable. And if what that means is that you need to pick a character in the parable, pick one of the players in the story, and imagine yourself to be that one, and see what happens to you in the parable, that might be as good a way as any to experience the parable from the inside. The effect of entering and experiencing the world of the parable and experiencing the amazing revelation of God's grace, God's love, God's welcome, God's forgiveness, God's generosity, is that once we leave the world of the parable, the regular world seems oddly foreign. It makes of us, in one sense, exiles in the world. People whose heart and home now is the world of the parable, the reign of God, the realm of God's grace, the kingdom of heaven. But then we live in the world with this kind of yearning and longing to enter again that world where God's grace takes precedence. In the parable, we live in a world where the prodigal child is welcomed with a resurrection feast. In the world of the parable, we experience the forgiveness of a debt so enormous that it dealt crushing death to someone. In the world of the parable, we experience the miraculous harvest reaped against all odds. But then when leaving that world, it's like walking outside of a theater after watching a matinee performance or a movie in the afternoon. When you've been in a dark theater, you've been drawn into another world completely, and then you walk out and the sunshine is, you know how that's stinging when the sun hits your eyes and you're disoriented for a while, and there is a moment coming out of a matinee performance when you think, I don't belong in this world out here, where your whole world has been so reordered by the drama or the film that you are not at home anymore in the afternoon sunshine. This is what happens to us inside the parables. We are given a foretaste, we are given a full taste in some sense of the presence of God among us, and we can no longer live in the same way in the regular world. So the result of entering the world of the parable is that we will live as exiles. We will live as people not at home in the world, but longing for the realm of grace and forgiveness and life that comes out of death. I've chosen as the very first parable to look at the story of the prodigal or the lost son. And this story has been given many different names depending on who is analyzing the story. Jeremias, whose books are in the bookstore. This is part of what I'm supposed to do. I'll show you these books that are available to you in the bookstore. Parables of Jesus and Rediscovering the Parables. Jeremias calls it, what does he call it? Okay, well, I'll remember it in a minute. Helmut Tillich calls it the parable of the waiting father because he believes it is the story of the father, of the father's love, of the father who waits for the return. Robert Capon calls it the story of the lost son rather than the story of the extravagant son or the wasteful son, because it is lostness that matters most to Capon. Jeremias calls it something else. I'll find out. The father's love, the story of the father's love. Prodigal, of course, doesn't mean bad or wayward. It just means wasteful, extravagantly, boundlessly wasteful. And so some scholars have called this the story of the prodigal father, because it is the father who, in fact, is wasteful, generous, ridiculously generous and wasteful with his goods and with his love. What I hope you experience today in the center of this parable is a welcome or a homecoming on earth as it is in heaven. A homecoming so profound, a welcome so generous and unearned, that you'll never be at home in the world again. I will read the whole story because it is beautifully written. If you want to follow along, it's in Luke 15. If you want simply to hear the story, which might actually have a more inviting manner to it, you can simply listen. I'm reading from the translation of the New Revised Standard Version, which is also available to you in the Holden Bookstore. Jesus said, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger of them said to his father, 'Father, give me the share of the property that will belong to me.' So he divided his property between them. A few days later, the younger son gathered all he had and traveled to a distant country, and there he squandered his property in dissolute living. When he had spent everything, a severe famine took place throughout that country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him to the fields to feed the pigs. He would gladly have filled himself with the pods the pigs were eating, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, he said, "How many of my father's hired hands have bread enough and to spare, and here I am dying of hunger. I will get up, go to my father, and I will say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against you and against God. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me like one of your hired hands.'" So he set off and went to his father, and while he was still far off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion. He ran and put his arms around him and kissed him. Then the father said to him, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son." But the father said to his slaves, "Quickly, bring out the robe, the best one, and put it on him. Put a ring about his finger and sandals on his feet, and get the fatted calf and kill it. And let us eat and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." And they began to celebrate. Gib, would you continue reading the second half of it for us now from the Bible that you have?
"Now his elder son was in the field. And as he came and drew near to the house, he heard music and dancing. And he called one of the servants and asked what this meant. And he said to him, 'Your father has come. And your brother has come, and your father has killed the fatted calf, because he has received him safe and sound.' But he was angry and refused to go in. His father came out and entreated him. But he answered his father, 'Lo, these many years I have served you, and I have never disobeyed your command. Yet you never gave me a kid, that I might make merry with my friends. But when this son of yours came, who was devoured, you're living with harlots, you killed for him the fatted calf.' And he said to him, 'Son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. It was fitting to make merry and be glad. For this your brother was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found.'"
Just a brief show of hands. How many of you, if you had to be asked, which you're now being asked, would identify most certainly, most completely, with the prodigal child, with the one who left home, squandered the property, was left among the pigs, and came home hoping for some kind of welcome? How many of you identify most strongly with that child? How many of you identify most strongly with the waiting parent, with the one who has a prodigal who has left, who is waiting for the prodigal to return, whose heart is leaning out towards this one? How many of you identify with the parent? How many of you identify most fully with the oldest son, who has been upright, loyal, dutiful, kind, trustworthy, clean, obedient, thrifty? Thank you. They never let me into the Boy Scouts for some obvious reason. How many of you identify with that one, who's also a little put out by the warm and extravagant reception the prodigal has received? Okay. If I had more time, I would divide us into those three groups and have you talk with one another about your feelings as this character and your feelings towards the other two characters. And I'd have you just think for a minute about that. Why are you the prodigal? What do you expect when you return home? Or why do you feel like the elder child? In my own life, I think I have been two of the characters, and I am probably going to become a third. So I think, I mean, I was the prodigal, I was the black sheep in my family, I was the one that my mother said gave her gray hair, I was the one who hitchhiked around the country and made my father cry over and over again by making myself unsafe, who always had a welcome at home, who received again and again that resurrection welcome, was never disowned. But I've also been the older child. I think that's who I am now. I'm pretty dutiful, pretty loyal, pretty thrifty, pretty clean, you know. I mean, not like the best, maybe, but better than most. I think that's how I sort of see myself. You know, I wouldn't put myself, you know, up on a pedestal like I put Dan Erlander. But I bet I'm not as bad as some of you. I mean, that's sort of my attitude, right? But as a campus pastor, I sometimes feel like I'm being called to that waiting parent. When I watch these people go away and renounce it all and denounce it all and leave home, and I wonder if my own daughters won't put me through that at some point. That aching, broken heart at the one who left, who desires nothing but the return and the resurrection of that one. So when I read this story, it depends on what part of me reads it, who I identify with most. This story is primarily about death and resurrection, says Robert Capon in his book, The Parables of Grace. How many of you are familiar with Capon's writing? He's written a book on marriage called Bed and Board, which I read and thought was just wonderful. And then I heard that he really was a scum to his wife and was unfaithful and left her for a younger woman. And then he began writing about grace and God's immeasurable love for those who have sinned. That's the, what do they call it, the ad hominem argument, which we're not supposed to get into. But let me share with you his understanding of this parable, because I think it's quite wonderful. He says it is a festival of death. A festival of death. And that it, most clearly, in Luke, is the parable that reveals to us this about God. God is in the business of, if you don't mind that analogy, raising the dead to life. That God has something to do when faced with the dead. In fact, God has something to do only when faced with the dead. God's work is to bring life and resurrection to the dead. And so, Capon says, the first death happens at the very beginning of the story, when the son comes to the father and says, I want you to act towards me as if you were dead. Or in other words, I want your will executed now. I want the property that would be mine once you were dead. In a sense, what the younger son is saying is, you are worth more to me dead, Dad, than you are to me alive. And so what the father does at the opening of the parable is lay down his life. He dies. He gives up his life, his substance, and his livelihood. And Capon argues this by looking at the Greek words, that when it talks about the father's living, the word is ton bios, meaning his life. What he divides is his life, is his substance, is what he is, and gives to the son that which he would receive after the father's death. So at the beginning of the parable, the father dies to the life he has. He lays down his living, his substance, his material worth. He lays it down and dies, and gives the younger son his part, and gives the older son the farm, basically. It begins with death. And then the son goes off and squanders in dissolute living, wastes the father's substance on whatever. I mean, the older brother later interprets it as harlots, but that may just be the older brother's guest. Wastes it on loose living, fast living, whether it was gorging himself or shooting up until it was gone or drinking till it was gone. He finds himself emptied of his father's substance. The life the father had given him now is gone, and he ends up in the pig pen, wishing he could eat the pods that he is told to feed the pigs. From the Jewish point of view now, we have to understand what this means for this younger son to find himself in the pig pen among these unclean animals. That the son has died both materially and spiritually. He has made himself religiously and spiritually unclean by his association with the pigs. And he has made himself materially dead by spending all of the livelihood he has. And then there's this moment of reckoning, which Capon says is a half step towards his death. He says, the Greek says, he came to himself. He woke up. He hit his head against reality. He opened his eyes. He looked at himself. And he says, my father's servants have a better life than I do in the pig pen. I am no longer worthy of being called a son of my father. But he gets this idea. I could work out a second kind of life for myself. I can't go back and ask to be a son, but I could go back and be hired on as a servant. Capon says he dies to a degree in the pig pen there by admitting to himself he has died to his right to be a son in the family, a child in the family. But he hangs on to some sense that he can resurrect himself, that he can create for himself a new life, albeit a somewhat lower level of life, by attaching himself to his father as a servant. So Capon says he hasn't died completely yet. He still is hanging on to the notion that he can make something of himself. He can work and earn a living and be a servant in the house. So he says, God can't do anything yet with this guy because he isn't completely dead. If you remember his premise that God's only work is with the dead. So he still isn't, God still can't do anything with him yet. But then we see, how many of you were here when they did when Lisa Johnson, I think is her name, did the mime of the prodigal son story? How many of you saw that? It was very moving and amazing, and I wish I could show you what it was like. I have a black shirt, but that's the only connection to that gift that I have. When she played all of the parts, the prodigal, the father, the elder brother, and would simply turn around quickly and become the other. It was an amazing transformation. But when she was the father, this is going to be bad. This is going to be great on tape. When she was the father, she was standing in the field, but there was this whole reaching out of her body, this whole yearning of her heart towards the son. And when the father saw the lost son running or coming down the road, you saw youth and life return to the father, came alive. There was a resurrection in the father as this hope, this longing was being fulfilled at the sight of the son, and he starts moving out. And it's very clear in this drama, this mime, that the father was the one who came out to the son, whose love reached the son before the son reached the father. Capon says the full death of the son happens at that moment in the embrace of the father, where the son now says, not, I am unworthy to be your son, but let me be your servant, but says simply, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am not worthy to be your son, period. Stop. I have died to the only life I had, which was the life as your child. And there Capon says the death of the prodigal is complete. He no longer is trying to create a second kind of life for himself as a servant, but just says, the only life I've been given, which was the life as your child in this household, is gone. I have died. I have died. And then Capon says, God has something to do. And what God does for those who have died, for those who are completely dead to the lives of their own making, is raise them to life. Capon goes on to say that he thinks, and this is where I disagree with him, but I think it's worth saying, that the fatted calf is the Christ figure. You know, and I don't know why we have to find a Christ figure in everything, but I don't think the fatted calf is the Christ figure. I don't think there's a Christ figure in this parable. But what he says is, and this I kind of like, he says, what is the life of the fatted calf except waiting in a stall for the moment that he can be killed in order that a party can happen? He says, who is Jesus except the one whose death is the occasion and the energy and the beginning of the party of our resurrection? So that's, you can do what you want to with that. But the youngest son, how do you like that, Dan? Yeah, I don't either, but you gotta. But yeah, I have to be faithful to what Capon is saying. So you can do what you want to with the Christ figure business. But it is interesting that there is yet another death, that the fatted calf dies in order that there can be a celebration. And Capon says a party is really what God's realm is about. That inside this parable, when you experience the welcome, if you are the prodigal, when you experience that welcome, you are invited out of chronological time that we keep and measure in order with our work and our duties and our clocks. You break out of that and enter a kairotic time, a time that bursts chronology open, and all of the doing and the cooking and the working and the laundry and the dishwashing and the bookkeeping and the point keeping and the measuring of how you're doing against others is exploded aside, and you're invited into a party in which there is no time except the time of God. And so it is the party of the resurrection. The son who was dead is now alive. Bring on the robes, the rings, the jewels, the feast, the wine, the dancing, and let it begin. Capon says, if you experience that moment of God's time in which all of the point-keeping and the bookkeeping is laid aside, you have tasted the realm of God here and now. And you will never be the same when you leave the parable. You will always be hungering again for the party, for the moment where what you have done does not count, only that you were dead and now you are alive. That is what matters. Then I have to read to you, because I can't say it better than he does, what he says about the elder son. And for you who identify most completely with this elder child, if you get too embarrassed listening to it because it hits too close to home, you can just kind of go like this and pretend you have something in your eye. Okay, then comes on solemn music, enter here in grand procession the Department of Ethics and Moral Theology, the faculty of the School of Religion, the deans and trustees of the law and business schools, and the representatives of the bursar's office. Enters the only live character left in the parable, the elder brother. Mr. Respectability, the man with volumes and volumes of the records he has kept on himself and everyone else. And as he came and drew nigh to the house, he heard music and dancing. He makes a stagey entrance, nostrils flared, eyes closed, back of right hand placed against his forehead. He gasps, music, dancing, levity, expense, and on a working day yet. And he called one of the servants and asked him what these things meant. He's not happy. Why this frivolity? What about the shipments that our customers wanted yesterday? Who's minding the store? And the servant said unto him, thy brother is come, and thy father hath killed the fatted calf, because he hath received him safe and sound. The brother rants, the fatted calf! Doesn't the old fool know I've been saving that for next week's sales promotion when we show our new line of turnips? How am I supposed to run a business when he blows the entertainment budget on that loser of a son? And he was so angry he would not go into the party. Finally, therefore, he makes a proclamation. I will not dignify this waste with my presence. Someone has to exercise a little responsibility around here. And Jesus, willing to oblige him with an important audience for all of this grousing, sends him one. Therefore, the father came out and entreated him. Well, the story goes on, and then this is how it ends. Isn't it?
This is Capon you're reading.
What? This is Capon I'm reading, yeah. Okay. But see, the father continued. He says, look, we're all dead here, and we're having a terrific time. We're all lost here, and we're feeling right at home. You, on the other hand, are alive and miserable. And worse yet, you're standing out there in the yard as if you were some kind of beggar. Why can't you see? You own this place, Morris. And the only reason you're not enjoying it is because you refuse to be dead to your dumb rules about how it should be enjoyed. So do yourself and everyone else a favor. Drop dead. Shut up. Forget about your stupid life. Go inside. Pour yourself a drink. Yeah. His point is good, isn't it? That God is in the business of raising the dead to life, and that most of us cling to some shadowy reflection of life, some kind of life of our own making, that is based on how we've lived, or what we've earned, or what we've done, or how nice we've been, or how faithful we've been, or in my case, how well I've cleaned up my act from the when I was a prodigal. You know, you can even, after having been a prodigal, become very self-righteous about that. A student the other day asked me if I ever had been a fundamentalist, and I said, you know, that was not a religious fundamentalist. For some reason, that affliction never affected me. But I was a nutritional fundamentalist for a while, very self-righteous about what I would eat and what I wouldn't eat, and very disdaining of the feasts that my mother would prepare. You killed an animal for us to eat, you know, and I'd look at the gravy and just say, how can you eat that grease? And I was so, you know, I ruined family meals for years by making everyone else feel so guilty about their celebrating, you know? It was because I was above that. I had seen a higher light, you know, a better way, and was earning my way by, so there are a lot of ways to be fundamentalists and a lot of ways to be self-righteous older children who have found a better way. And what I didn't realize, what I came to realize later, is that I was killing the joy of the family by imposing rules on the way people should celebrate, telling my family what was a proper way to enjoy life and what was an improper way to enjoy life. And I wonder now at the fact that my father didn't ever stand up and just look at me and say, Susan, do yourself and everyone else a favor and drop dead, you know, in order that you might be raised to a life that is not so bound by legalisms, by rules, by measuring your actions against other people's. Inside this parable, then, in the world of this parable, we who are prodigals are invited to experience a welcome that is so overpowering and so life-giving that we cannot be the same again. And in this parable, we who are older children are invited to ask the question, to what have I not yet died in order that I might be raised to a new life? What false way of living of my own making am I holding on to that keeps me really from dropping dead in order that God, whose work is to raise the dead to life, can do the work that needs to be done in me? And I think there's a third question that we're left with, and that is those of us who are the community of faith and the church, which people would argue is largely made up of the older children, you know, the ones who never had the guts to leave, you know? Never could do anything so bad that they felt excluded. What kind of image do we give the prodigals? What kind of image, what kind of welcome do we as the church extend to those who feel like they no longer belong? To that end, I want to read to you, this is a kind of risky thing to do, but I decided to do it, a little story that I wrote, which is one of these stories that is true but not factual. Do you know about those stories? So the point isn't who is Roberta in the story, but where is the truth in the story? About a prodigal who had deep memories, as did the prodigal son, deep memories of a home and a time and a love that was welcoming, memories that now were being stirred again. And the question is asked, can I go home? Will there, in the community of faith, be the resurrection reception for me that has been tasted in this parable? I mean, that's a hard question for the community of faith. But are we prepared as the community of faith to give this reception both to the prodigal and to the elder son once, if by God, he drops dead? Are we ready to say, come into the party, feast at the table, taste the reign of God present with us? This is the little story. The day after Thanksgiving, as Roberta wandered through the shopping mall, the display window of a card and gift shop caught her eye. There, nestled in an ocean of cotton snow and surrounded by wooden gingerbread men and tree ornaments, was an Advent wreath. And the small placard read, 1995, with four candles. When did these become marketable? She wondered. She was oddly offended, as if something sacred from her past were being cheapened. She was surprised by her strong reaction. After all, she could hardly remember the last time she had been to church. But then that really wasn't true. Though years had passed, she remembered it as if it were yesterday. It had been spring break during her first year at the university. Only days before, she had found out she was pregnant and had come home struggling to decide whom to tell, where to go, what to do. Sitting in church on that distant Sunday, she had felt completely alone. She thought she had no right to be among these good Christian people, because she knew that if they knew the truth, they wouldn't want her there. And after she made her decision about what to do, she knew for certain she could never go back. And now, standing in front of the shop window and staring at the Advent wreath, she thought, this Sunday they will light the first candle at church on the wreath, and they will begin their waiting, their watching, and their hoping for the coming light. She could almost smell the flame, see the flame, and smell the pine boughs as she remembered the advents of her childhood. She hummed a melody inside her head, "Wake, awake, for night is flying." And she wondered, could I go back? Could I go home this year just to see them light the first candle on the wreath? Memories of home, of his father's home, of enough to eat, of a place to belong, of reception, of love, were stirred in the prodigal when he was among the pigs, and that was what began his turning around. They think about the Robertas that I have known, who have deep inside them memories of that foundational love and belonging that they knew when they were growing up in the family, in the community of faith, but who have discovered something about themselves, have done what they think the community would disapprove of, have rebelliously or wastefully spent the love they had, still have those stirrings of memories, as Roberta did, and they wonder, can they go back? Having done what they've done, knowing what they know, being who they are, can they go home? And what will they find in the community of faith? And it's a question that I think I live with a lot as a campus pastor, because I know students often during their time of leaving, and I don't know what they'd find when they go home. Is the community large enough for them? Is the embrace welcoming enough? Is a word of resurrection there for them in their death and in their fear and in their shame and in their questions? So that's where I'm left in exile coming out of this parable, is even looking at my own church. I long for the community where that embrace, where that resurrection from the dead, where that promise of new life, that gift of belonging invites those who have died, whether they have died as prodigals or as self-righteous elders. And I long for the community that I taste inside this parable, the community of the reign of God among us. And that's what I look for. That's where I wander around. I've left some time for responses and questions. It's a kind of a weird ending, isn't it? I have a prayer we can pray at the end if we need more closure for the Jays in the group. Any questions or responses to this?
Was that the end of Roberta's story?
Yep.
Just wondering.
We can write the rest of it.
Yeah, how would you end it? Can she go home? Can she go home to your parish?
She'll go home.
Well, I guess the question is, how often is the perception that they can't go home not a real one? Would their reception be a lot greater than their anticipation leads them to believe?
And who is responsible for the perception that the church gives to a young Roberta sitting the first Sunday of Advent in church, knowing she's pregnant and unwed, surrounded by these people who seem to her to be perfect? I mean, at what point has the perception been developed that she can't say out loud where she is, what's happened to her? Will there be a home for her?
It could be real, it could be her imagination, it could be the atmosphere, it could be lots of things. I don't know. But I think there are many times when probably that perception that she has maybe is not the correct one.
Yeah. Well, I think there is I think about my own life, I always consistently underestimated the depth and the power of my parents' love for me. Always underestimated it. Never overestimated it. Always assumed that it was my being good that gave me a place in that family. I'm very frightened to test that very often. You know.
I appreciate your comments so much, because it made me realize, as I look at sort of the two of the key figures who set the perceptions, the big challenge for me always is to live my life in anticipation of the father's response rather than my older brother's response. And I think so much of the time I live in the perception is that I set my course against how the older brothers are going to respond to me. And so I'm cautious. I don't talk about what's really happening to me. I don't reveal the side. You've talked about Susan, the prodigal side. And I don't trust the fact that there is a loving community that will respond like the Father has and welcome me back in. So for me, the challenge of faith so much is to live in anticipation of the gospel promise or the Father's promise rather than the ones I'm fearful of.
One of the questions is, you know, what would a church be like if at the beginning of worship an announcement was made, this is a community of the dead. Mm-hmm. You know, we are all dead in here. I mean, sometimes it does feel like that.
Yeah.
For the wrong reasons, yeah.
Yeah.
But the church often tries to present itself as the community of those who are doing it right, or at least, you know, trying to do it right, at least not doing it as wrong as the rest of the folks.
Don't you suppose that's what the purpose of the confession should be? I mean, I'm not sure that's what actually happens, but, you know, that's the saying.
That's right. That's right.
I think if you take if you take your character home, she'll be highly disappointed looking for that pine bough and the candle. She'll probably come home and find a plastic cabinet waiting for the light bulb coming up. That's great. At the very beginning, you mentioned how you interpret the word chronicle. That's one of the few biblical words that has not moved into common language anywhere.
Huh.
They haven't made adjectives. You can't talk about prodigality or anything like that. I don't find it anywhere else in human language. Yet everybody has an understanding of the word chronicle. Mm.
And I think most people think it just means sinful, wrong, bad. The prodigal son is the one who screwed up, not wasteful, which is what I think the word means. Yeah.
One concrete thing that our church has done, which is kind of robed in a way that I think it really is helpful, is that our pastor has preached on specific issues sometimes and God's response and the Christian community response. I've had a sermon about divorce and a sermon about chemical dependency and talked about, you know, about God's grace and the community's response to sort of, I mean, it's pretty roped, but it's both telling the people that are there, maybe are talking about it, that it's already talked about it, and telling people in the Christian community what our role is in being more supportive. And I think that has been helpful to some people, that it's just openly talked about, that these are problems we all are touched by. It's not just something that, so I think at least opens it up.
I was going to say, too, in response to your question about, you know, they should know that we love them or whatever, you know, I mean, it's kind of like the Norwegian who got married and said, I told my wife I loved her, you know, the day I married her, and if I change my mind, I'll let her know. Sometimes I think in order to change the perception, we have to really go out of our way to say it's okay to be here and not assume, you know, like you said, that you always underestimated the welcome that was there. And I think that that's real typical, especially of people in that stage of development. And sometimes you have to go out of your way to say it's okay to be here and not assume that they know it's okay to be there. And I think that's, as a church, that's where we struggle finding ways to do that.
I want to say one thing, that in the prodigal son, we're not to say that the father is equals God. That would be making this into an allegory. But in this father's welcome and love, we do glimpse the love of God. We do glimpse the welcome, the homecoming of God. But the key here is that the father also has died. And maybe that's part of telling people that they're welcomed here, is to say, I too don't belong. I too haven't earned my right to be here. I too am dead and made alive. And I really like your connection with the brief order of confession and forgiveness, because that is, in fact, we can't go on with the party. We can't come to the feast of the table until we have said out loud, we are dead and helpless to raise ourselves. Thanks be to God, we are raised.
Part of our problem is, he says through a parables of grace, right out loud, that's the whole problem, which we just can't accept it. Just because somebody wants to give it to us, we have to earn it, we have to justify it. I just got done teaching my adult Sunday school class before I left on this, and one of the women just reamed me out for 5 minutes because I was being negative, because God wanted me to have all these good things. And I finally stopped the class and I said, hey folks, do I sound negative to you? And 9 other people said, no, you don't sound negative. And this woman is whipped because I'm telling her that God's grace is undeserved. He does it just because we're his children. He loves us. He cares for us. And when people come back to the church, this goody two-shoes, and this is the woman that did it to me, is sitting there in judgment because this person hasn't been in church for 3 Sundays,
yeah,
or they haven't dressed their kids properly that day, or some other foolishness, which doesn't matter one bit. But to her, this is so important. And I see the father really giving to the prodigal son his undying grace. Mm-hmm. It's all yours, kid. And the other kid could have had it, and he wanted to keep the records.
Exactly.
It seems to me like the fact of the matter is, like it or not, you can't build a church, you can't build an institution on progress. You know, you need people who will show up, who will be at the meetings, who will take care of the dinners, who will
wash all those little cups.
Yeah, wash all. You know, that's to build a church on the progress is probably.
Isn't the church made up of prodigals, though?
Huh?
See, what occurred to me is, when you were saying, who are you? Which one are you? I couldn't say to myself who I am. When I was working in a congregation as an intern, the thing that occurred to me was, everyone here is prodigal, they just know how to cover it up.
Sure.
And so they become the righteous brother.
Sure.
And as you talked about prodigal as well, you said it's wasteful. And doesn't the church waste constantly the gifts that we have in the church? And so what's the connection there?
The question is, are we dead prodigals or are we
are we active prodigals?
Living. Yeah.
I'm taking on from what you said about language too. Language is very important in the church, and some of the Robertas who try to come back can't hear what the people are saying because the language is old or too new or some of the language, the words are loaded for them. And then also, of course, tradition. You talked about the pine bough and the candle. Well, we can't or don't always keep those traditions. She probably wouldn't find that. We are different. We are varied. But the point in saying that, some of that, is to keep a balance between the new perceptions and the new creations and the new images and the new language, and also with the old that's very meaningful and very sweet to us. And it, for the Robertas, that's sometimes very...
To close, I'll leave you with a question and then we'll pray a prayer. Imagine that a person you do not know very well and have not known very long gives you on your birthday a totally unreasonable and extravagant and personal gift. What is your response to this gift? Is it, well, what is your response to this gift? Huh? You're embarrassed.
Give it back.
Can't accept it.
Can't accept it. Have to find out, huh?
Sam's, it would be if someone I knew very well gave me an extravagant gift.
Okay. Okay.
It doesn't matter who the giver is.
Okay. You're worse off than.
Yeah, I'm off the chart.
My response is, I've got to find out when this person's birthday is, and I've got to give an equal gift in return to equalize the scale. Or to just not accept, to say, I can't accept this. I can't. It's one reason I don't have a diamond ring. This is one of the most ridiculous stories of my life. But I said to my husband, this man who wanted to give me his life, I mean, who wanted to live with me for the rest of my life, I said, I couldn't accept anything, you know, as valuable as a diamond ring. So I made up this thing about, you know, it's the bride price, I refuse to be bought, and it's a symbol I don't want any part of. But deep down in it, in me, was, I don't have a way to give him a diamond back, you know. What a weird way to go into a marriage, you know. But I still can't accept gifts like that. I think that says something to us about our response to this grace that is unreasonably, extraordinarily extravagant. But it is what we have been offered. And when we die, it is the life we receive today. Let's close with a prayer to keep faith with the coffee hour time. I have 10 o'clock right now. Is that what you have?
Yes. Yeah.
Let us pray. Most gracious and welcoming God, your mercy is abundant and your love unending. Receive us when we wander. Forgive us when we sin. Give us new life when we die. And by your grace, empower us to offer your love, your mercy, and your welcome to others through Jesus Christ, who is our life. Amen. Amen. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.